Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Is it really possible that Akio Toyoda didn't know that sticky pedals were causing his best-selling car to sometimes race out of control? As it turns out, yes. Car analyst Paul Eisenstein says that at Toyota, employees didn't just hide bad news from the public, they even hid it from their own managers.
Really scary, though, is that what we're now seeing is a company that seems enmeshed in secrecy.
In hindsight, the automaker may now be wishing they had been less protected against bad news. In hindsight, Akio Toyoda probably wishes he could have avoided having to say this.
I myself, as well as Toyota, am not perfect. At times, we do find defects.
Sometimes, I guess, no news is really bad news. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Thursday, February 25th. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, Celeste. It's good to be back.
We've missed you.
Yeah, I miss the Florida weather already, though.
You know, is this Toyota story? You know when your kids, something bad happens at school and you find out later that they didn't tell you and they say, well, I didn't want you to worry.
A lot of worrying going on at Toyota. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. In about 2 hours, President Obama and 22 influential lawmakers will lock themselves in a room at the Blair House for 6 hours and try to come up with common ground on health care reform. It'll all be televised, but no breakthroughs are expected. And Toyota President Akio Toyoda says he's moving forward.
Toyota's car is safe.
It's the message he tried to get across to Congress and the American public on Capitol Hill yesterday. And there was also this.
I am deeply sorry for any accident that Toyota drivers have experienced.
34 deaths have been linked to the Toyota safety lapses. The company's president insisted the problem is not, however, with the car's massive electronic systems throughout its product line.
For details on Toyota's testimony, we're joined now by Michael O'Brien, staff writer for The Hill. Michael, earlier this week, James Lentz, president of Toyota Motor Sales USA, told Congress that the solution to the acceleration problem would come from Japan. So did Akio Toyoda tell us how they're going to fix it?
Well, Mr. Toyota said his company's doing its best to fix their problems, but maybe not to the level of satisfaction that Congress was looking for.
But they said they have completely ruled out the electronic system as the cause.
Yes. Mr. Toyota said he's completely confident that the electrical systems are not to blame, although he did admit that they're really not sure what has caused them at this point, which spurred a level of frustration at yesterday's hearings.
Okay, stay with us, Michael O'Brien. We'll be back with you in a moment.
U.S. officials are calling it a new beginning, not mission accomplished for one city in Afghanistan. As several hundred residents looked on, the red, black, and green flag of Afghanistan was raised this morning over the former Taliban stronghold of Marja. NATO forces continue a mop-up operation in the city. Top U.S. Commander Stanley McChrystal told the Times of London yesterday, NATO forces will soon turn their attention to the province of Kandahar. Australia has summoned the Israeli ambassador to explain why three new suspects in the Dubai killing of a Hamas leader used Australian passports. The three, two men and a woman, were named after among 15 new suspects.
And a killer whale at Orlando's SeaWorld killed its trainer in front of a horrified audience yesterday. Witnesses say the 12,000-pound whale snatched the trainer off a platform by her waist, held her underwater in its jaws, and drowned her. And at the Olympics, the U.S. men's hockey team beat Switzerland 2-0. Canada gave Russia a good old-fashioned walloping. They won 7-3. Looking at the markets, futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,374, the S&P at 11,105, and the Nasdaq at 2235.
Tech Thursday, we're going to talk about the conviction of three Google executives in Italy and what it means for internet free speech. Is there such a thing? And Frustration Nation continues. Our series is about what civics teachers are teaching students about American government in these days. Coming up next, we're going to talk more about Toyota facing a congressional panel and what the president has had to say. That in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Toyota's CEO Akio Toyoda testified on Capitol Hill yesterday.
Well, I didn't want to be him yesterday.
I haven't wanted to be him for a few weeks now.
Yikes.
Striking a very contrite and remorseful tone, Toyota stressed again his company's commitment to safe vehicles. He spoke in English in his opening remarks before he switched over to Japanese and used the services of an interpreter while lawmakers questioned him.
In the past few months, our customers have started to feel uncertain about the safety of Toyota's vehicle, and I take full responsibility for that.
Let's return now to Michael O'Brien, staff writer for The Hill. Michael, you were at yesterday's congressional hearings. The lawmakers were a little less confrontational. They pushed back a little bit less than we expected on Toyota. Is that because of language difficulties?
Yeah, the translation between Mr. Toyota and the congressman really sort of slowed down the pace of the hearing, allowed for maybe a less confrontational atmosphere. Still, it really got testy at points, and lawmakers were clear in showing their frustration at Mr. Toyota and Mr. Inaba.
Did Akio Toyota offer any new information, new details on the incident to kind of satisfy some of the questions and confusion that's been going on?
Well, yes and no. He said that, you know, because he had become CEO of the company in only June of 2009, he was only privy to some information. He said he first was aware of the acceleration problems in December of 2009, but lawmakers were a little skeptical of that. They wanted to know more about when the company was aware of its sudden acceleration problems.
And did he explain why that had been going on while he was president, but no one had told him for 6 or 7 months?
Right. It was Mr. Inaba who really fielded this a little bit more. He's the head of their North American operations. And what he blamed was sort of a diffuse infrastructure within the company that really hindered them from being able to connect the dots in their sudden acceleration problems in different lines across the world. So they're pledging a greater effort to try and coordinate their global brands and identify problems sooner.
Well, as you said, Toyota did not give any definitive answer as to what's causing sudden acceleration problems. I imagine not getting an answer to that question is not going to satisfy Congress. Michael O'Brien is a staff writer for The Hill. And I want to bring in now Deborah Hayden. She's the managing partner in Japan for Kreab Gavin Anderson. It's a corporate communications consultancy. Deborah, a lot has been written about the so-called the Toyota way. They have 14 guiding principles that have been actually emulated, copied by other corporations around the world. And in the Toyota way, they insist managers actually get out from behind their desks, go and see and solve problems at the source. But there's little in those principles that actually talks about communication coming from the ground up.
Hi, Celeste. No, that's certainly a very good point to start with. I think as in any crisis, it's always hard for bad news to move up a company. It certainly moves up very, very slowly. Your natural human reaction is to think, gosh, you know, is there something I can do to solve this myself before I, you know, at least bring a solution to my boss? And I think in Japan and in many other Asian countries, this is slightly compounded by the Confucian principles of respect for your superior. So, and we've got a society here where it's actually really difficult to actually bring up a problem to your boss where you actually don't know the answer. So I think that's probably one of the things that's played into the situation. I think another thing here too, and you mentioned the word communications, is that the way that communications sort of fits into, you know, business continuity planning and crisis planning in Japan is a little bit different. Certainly their business continuity plans, for example, if a generator breaks down, you know, how do you get the plant up and running again, you know, tried and tested to perfection. But the communications aspect of where this fits with, if there's a problem, is often a sort of a last-minute afterthought. It's like, oh, let's call in those PR folks and get them to give us a couple of bullet points about what we should do if someone calls us up. And I think compared to, say, companies in the West, particularly in a situation like Toyota, where, you know, you're making cars, which at the end of the day are products, if there is something that goes wrong, you know, people's lives are at stake. They should have been more prepared that something like this could happen, and that should have been not only a business continuity plan, but it also should have been a communications plan going right in lockstep of what do we do, who do we talk to, who are our key audiences, who are the right people to communicate this, and that should have been something that had been etched on people's brains, not sitting in a manual that was sort of gathering dust in the back of one of the cupboards.
And you may have really touched on what's really at heart here, because certainly this the recall of these cars, while tragic in their situations, is not extreme. Ford Motor Company actually holds the record for the most recalls of any automaker since we've been keeping records. But there was a mismanagement of the PR of this recall. There was a mismanagement not only over how they handled the problems when they first discovered them, but also how they handled the press when they were released to the public.
I think, we've had a very interesting situation here. Part of it goes back again to Japanese corporate culture, where there's, if you're, one of the company soldiers that has been there since you graduated from university, you're one of the insiders. And it's very important. It's like being part of a family. They'll look after you. You're part of a family. You've got, the guiding principles and the ethics to uphold. And so it's very hard for this group to actually admit outsiders. It's hard to have somebody come in who's not part of that inside group, for example, an outside consultant. It's hard to get a third perspective on some of the issues. Most large companies of a similar stature in the US, for example, would have an army of PR and kind of public relations and public affairs advisors who would be always on standby, who would know the company backwards, who would know, be ready to jump to an issue when it was needed. This isn't the case necessarily with many Japanese companies, and particularly not with Toyota.
Well, let me ask you about the corporate culture there. Having the most important CEO of the largest company in Japan called to answer to American lawmakers, is that an embarrassment for CEOs and executives and the corporations in Japan?
This is certainly, I think, a very unusual situation. It's the first time this has happened for Japanese companies. But, Japanese executives do get called into the Japanese equivalent of Congress, the Diet, from time to time to explain situations as well. I'm glad he went over. I'm glad he went and talked to Congress. And I'm glad that he's sort of standing at the head of the company and now communicating, which is, what he should be doing.
Okay, Deborah Hayden is a managing partner in Japan for the Kreab Gavin Anderson Company. It's a corporate communications consultancy. And we also spoke with Michael O'Brien, a staff writer for The Hill, talking about Akio Toyoda's appearance at a congressional hearing yesterday on Capitol Hill. And now it's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on the headlines.
Well, Senate Democrats delivered yesterday a major jobs bill. New York Senator Chuck Schumer says the bill includes an incentive for businesses to hire the unemployed.
It is a holiday from the payroll tax for any employer who hires a worker who has been out of work for 60 days.
The bill also includes an extension of state highway funding. Today, President Obama and members of Congress will weigh in on health care reform during a six-hour meeting that will be broadcast live on television. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell will be there.
If the White House wants real bipartisanship, then it needs to drop the proposal it posted Monday, which is no different in its essentials than anything we've seen before, and start all over.
Well, the healthcare reform meeting gets underway at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, and you can hear it live at thetakeaway.org.
A big day at the Olympics today. 7 medal events scheduled, including women's ice hockey and freestyle men's skiing, both of which the U.S. has a chance to win. At the games yesterday, the U.S. took home 2 bronze medals. One of the winners was bobsled competitor Alana Myers.
We came in trying to stay calm, trying to stay relaxed and have a little fun, and that's what we did. All 4 runs were a blast. Every single run, I looked over Aaron and just had the biggest grin on my face.
And that's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, we'll get a preview of the healthcare summit that we talked about and why some Republicans are already saying,
I don't see any reason to allow the president to have a 6-hour infomercial about his bill.
That is Senate Minority Leader John Boehner, and we're going to talk more about the healthcare summit and whether or not it will achieve bipartisanship in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Also, our first takeout. News unclear. Spectacle, it certainly will be. But the healthcare reform summit for 6 hours in Washington, convened by the White House, in the middle of a snowstorm, will it get anything done? That's really the question. And if you take House Minority Leader John Boehner as a guide, well...
I don't see any reason to allow the president to have a six-hour infomercial about his bill. And I have no problems going down there and pointing out what I believe the flaws in his bill are and outlining what we think are common sense steps to make our system work better.
Will they get anything done? Well, we thought we would ask former co-host of The Takeaway and currently Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, who's back in the Capitol just in time for a snowstorm, whether they will get anything done on this summit. Good morning, Todd.
Welcome back, John.
Thank you very much. Thanks for filling in.
Sure. Oh, it was a pleasure. I had a great time, by the way. Hi, Celeste.
Hi, Todd.
So, John, the question, will they get anything done? I mean, from the sounds of John Boehner right there, it doesn't seem like they will. There are no signs going into this healthcare summit that there's going to be any form of substantive negotiation on a new plan going on. You know, earlier in the week we said that the White House introduced a new plan, sort of a plan by the president that really tilts heavily towards the Senate bill, and Republicans don't like that bill either. So while John Boehner says Republicans are, you know, they're calling this an infomercial and coming in really to point out the flaws in the president's plan, at the same time, Democrats are formulating a legislative strategy on their own, which is going to alienate Republicans even more. It's called reconciliation, and the bottom line is they can try to pass the president's sort of new bill with no Republican support whatsoever. You bypass the filibuster. It's not the first time it's ever been done. It's not unheard of, but it's not bipartisan. It's the furthest thing from bipartisan.
And it seems like it's been talked about a lot, but as an actual threat, leveraging this summit into some sort of actual meaningful debate, I think that's kind of unclear. But you'll be there, right, Todd?
Well, it's pooled coverage, so yeah. None of us will be in the room, but I'll be glued to the TV.
All right, Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, talking about the healthcare summit convening in a couple of hours in Washington.
Our next takeout comes from the Winter Olympics in Vancouver, Canada. Amidst some foggy, snowy conditions yesterday, disaster on the ski slopes, at least for the Americans.
Oh, that looked Lindsey Vonn right in the center of that gate. Looked like she caught an edge and rockets into the fencing down there.
That was NBC's broadcast of Lindsey Vonn crashing during the giant slalom. Not only did she end up with a broken finger, but her crash also disrupted her teammate Julia Mancuso's run. Here to explain is Jason Stallman from our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning.
First of all, how did Lindsey crash?
Just a really strange scene up at Whistler. She was having a great run on the giant slalom, but the conditions were just treacherous, really foggy, snow blowing all over the place. She was having a strong run about two-thirds of the way through, about 150 yards from the finish line. Her left ski just kind of came out from under her, and she went down pretty hard, slid into the fencing around the course, and she was out.
And clearly that was a problem for her run, but how did it affect Julia Mancuso's run?
Yeah, really unusual turn of events. What happened was, because the course officials were trying to expedite the race, they let Mancuso start before Vonn was finished. That's somewhat uncommon. So Mancuso had started her run. They had to wave the yellow flag about halfway down and take her up on a snowmobile back to do a rerun, is what they call it, and she was distraught. She was really, really emotionally upset because she knew that the conditions were only getting worse, and she wanted to get her run in as soon as possible. She ended up finishing 18th off that first run.
Well, that's too bad. But we had news not just in skiing yesterday, but in hockey as well. Both the U.S. and Canadian teams have advanced to the semifinals.
Boy, did they. I should probably apologize up front if there's too much background noise here, because my hotel happens to be on Robson Street, the heart of downtown Vancouver. And I don't know, but what is it, 10, 12 hours after the Canada-Russia game, there's still hundreds, if not thousands, of people celebrating out on Robson. It's a pretty nutty scene here. They treated it like a gold medal game. It really does seem like Canada just won a gold in hockey after destroying Russia 7-3. Meanwhile, the United States gets past Switzerland in a really close game. They won 2-0. So Canada and the United States on to the semifinals.
Pretty exciting. Okay, thanks so much, Jason. Jason is the Olympics editor, Jason Stallman, for our partner, The New York Times. And now, a sports takeout that's not from the Olympics. The NCAA sent a letter to the University University of Michigan. They've accused the school of major rules violations. One of the charges is that Michigan is accused of making this athlete's practice more than the requisite 8 hours a week. But that's just one of several charges. Here to explain is Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. The NCAA has launched this investigation. This was after months of looking into the problem. And it looks like now they've said, yes, you committed major rules violations. So what happens now?
So let's peel back a little bit. College football players, they practice about 25 to 30 hours per week in season. Then out of season, that reduces considerably, and that's where that 8 hours comes from per week. So you have all these players off season. It's the calm time of the year, and they're being still drilled pretty heavily. Michigan hasn't had a winning season in two seasons, so now the coach is really driving them hard to try and force them essentially to win. So that's where this is the context that this is coming under, that you have all these players that have to prove themselves and a coach that has to prove himself, so they're driving them practicing too hard to do it.
Right, but they've violated the rules, and I guess the big question here is whether or not they did it intentionally or whether, as Michigan claims, it was an accident. So the NCAA is going to come back with their findings in 90 days, I guess, but that's right as the football season is getting geared up.
Exactly. So they didn't accurately report how many hours that they were practicing, and that is the issue here, is what is the system of reporting of the hours of practice. Now, if they actually get some sanctions, the question is, are they going to do self-imposed sanctions within Michigan, or are they going to have the NCAA impose the sanctions themselves? To me, it's kind of like getting an industry that's faulty, maybe the car industry, regulating itself. I'm not sure if Michigan is the best person to regulate themselves. I think that the NCAA should step in and do a more thorough audit.
Well, it could end up eventually, conceivably, with a bowl ban for the University of Michigan, one of the most winning football programs in the country. Thanks so much. That's Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. More in our series, Frustration Nation and the Gridlock in Washington. It's coming up.
Coming up, we check in with a high school civics teacher and some high school students in Frustration Nation looking for teachable moments in what's going on in Washington right now. But let's check in on some of the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. In Afghanistan, a single U.S. general is calling it a new beginning. As several hundred residents looked on, the Afghan flag was raised this morning over the former Taliban stronghold of Marja. NATO spokesman Brigadier General Eric Tremblay says NATO troops are still sweeping the city.
Some insurgents do not want to reintegrate, do not want to reconcile, and we're going to have to permanently push them off.
Meanwhile, top U.S. Commander Stanley McChrystal told the Times of London yesterday that NATO forces will soon turn their attention to the province of Kandahar.
Here at home, a former New Orleans policeman has pleaded guilty to covering for officers who killed two men in the chaos following Hurricane Katrina. The shootings happened 6 days after the storm, when police are accused of firing at unarmed people crossing a bridge in search of food. Education Secretary Arne Duncan is applauding the move to fire every single teacher at a Rhode Island high school. The firings, effective at the end of the school year, came after the district failed to reach an agreement with the teachers' union on a plan to improve lagging test scores. Deborah Gist is the Rhode Island Education Commissioner.
We will not have schools in our state who year after year after year fail to serve children well.
The union plans to fight the decision. And Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke isn't giving any clues as to when interest may be increased. He said we can expect unemployment, though, to decline at a very slow rate over the next couple of years. Taking a look at the markets, Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down as well. The Dow will start at 10,374. The S&P opens at 1,105, and the Nasdaq starts at 2,235. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
There is much too much ideology, not enough practical progress.
People are angry, and they are frustrated that perhaps it hasn't been a fast enough change.
Even at a time of enormous national challenge, the people's business is not getting done.
I don't want you to feel discouraged.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
So our Frustration Nation segment this morning begins with a question to you. Listen to this voice and see if you can hear, is it hope or is it just giving up?
There's so much going on in Washington right now and so much not getting done.
I feel like future generations and the people right now have a great opportunity to step up and change it, and it just makes me want to get more involved and have my voice heard.
Punt the whole business to future generations, or is that hope of young people looking at the situation in Washington and trying to figure out how their government actually works? That's Danielle Rodillo, who's a senior at Howell High School in Michigan. And we thought we'd extend that conversation and get some voices who can actually answer some of those questions. Alan Broadman joins us. He's a civics teacher at East Brunswick High School in New Jersey. He joins us from his home. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning.
Michael Head is also with us. He's a senior at North Hall High School in Gainesville, Georgia. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
And a junior at Detroit School of the Arts is Amina Green, who joins us from Detroit. Good morning, Amina.
Good morning.
All right, Alan, first of all, you know, as I was thinking about talking to you this morning, not only do you have an enormous set of lessons from the last few months in Washington, but if you go back to the election, I mean, you've gone from a peak of hope and a sense of possibilities with the election in 2008 to something very, very different right now. Explain briefly how that arc affects what you teach as a civics teacher.
Well, it's one of the interesting things when you think about it, and it's a wonderful civics lesson because it distinguishes between what an election is and then what running a government is. And those are two very distinctly different things. And it's a wonderful perspective for the students to understand that. It's also frustrating because they don't fully grasp at times why the one can't be the same as the other.
You know, I was looking at comments from some of your students, Alan, and I want to take this right to Amina Green. It seems to me that young people are really hip to what's going on in Washington in the sense that a lot of people that I see in blogs and in comments really have concluded that people in Washington like it this way. They complain a lot, but they really like this division where nothing gets done. Is that what you're seeing, Amina Green, from Detroit?
Actually, yes, it really is. It's like politics has become more or less about the R or the D behind your name than actually getting anything done. It seems like everything each party has, the other party says no, but they don't want to really give any alternatives. It's more of just back and forth bickering between siblings.
And Michael Head, a senior at North Hall High School in Gainesville, Georgia, how does the Constitution and the way the government works in Washington end up rewarding people who just sort of dig in their heels?
I don't think it really rewards anybody. We don't get anything done. It doesn't benefit us as a country. I think that if we need to be successful in this country, we need to start working together, not be divided. Just like that girl said before me, we need to stop bickering like brothers and sisters and need to get things done.
Well, as a civic student, okay, as a senior at a high school, what in the Constitution is a lever that can be pulled to maybe make some things happen here? And then I'll take it back to the teacher, Alan Broadman, in just a moment. Michael? It's a hard one.
Yeah, it's actually very hard.
Alan Broadman will help us out here.
Yeah, I think there are a number of places, and I think we look generally initially to the concept of what the Constitution is. It starts with we the people, which means it's our government, popular sovereignty. We have a role here to play. We play that through the simple concept, arguably, of elections, where we vote. But we also do that with our freedom of speech and the freedom of press. Okay, our opportunity to participate in government, I think, is the key way for us to attempt to break this logjam.
But if we only participate once every 4 years, Michael Head, do you hear your voice? Do you see your voice being expressed on Capitol Hill at all?
No, like I don't feel like I have any say-so in anything.
So, Amina Green, how about you? Do you have any say-so? Do you see and hear your voice? And if you don't, I suspect both of you need to pull out the pitchforks, right?
Yes, I don't hear my voice being heard. It's just a bunch of loudness everywhere besides, you know, hearing myself. It's just, well, gridlock, and there's nothing going on, so.
All right, now, Alan Broadman, I mean, that level of cynicism after a historic election in 2008 has got to be something of a toxin from your perspective as a teacher who's trying to engage and prepare students to participate in a democracy.
Most assuredly, and that's part of the problem. Unfortunately, the system places both of the two people who've just spoken, both of our students, in a position where their voices are less heard. Why? They don't have a vote.
And
I'm not advocating for a younger vote, but the point is that is part of the frustration level that my students feel as well. Okay, and therefore they have to rely on what are perceived as secondary means of addressing problems, speaking up, okay? But it is a toxin. It does cause a problem. But the key from when I'm teaching this is to say, okay, that's the issue. Now how do we fix that?
All right, Michael Head, are you more or less likely to vote when you can vote in the first presidential election based on what's happened in the last few months?
No, I think I'm more likely to vote.
That's
good. I want to have my say in what happens in this election. It's my nation, too, just like everybody else's, and I want to have a say-so.
Amina Green, more or less likely to vote based on what's happened in the last few months?
More likely, just as he just said, you know, it's my nation, and I have a say-so, so I would like to say who gets in and who doesn't.
All right, well, we got that going for us. Michael Head, senior at North Hall High School in Gainesville, Georgia, and Amina Green, junior at Detroit School of the Arts, and Alan Broadman, a teacher, taking it home, civics teacher at East Brunswick High School there in New Jersey. Thanks to all of you. Alan Broadman has written more on teaching civics while government is deadlocked. It's on our website now. Go to thetakeaway.org. And our question to you today, what do you think it will take to make the two parties get along on health care? A summit, a compromise on a specific issue,
are independents
just becoming a third party? Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can hear the President's Healthcare Summit live at thetakeaway.org at 10 a.m. Eastern Time.
We're going to be talking about technology because it's Thursday, and today we're going to talk a little bit, delve deeper into the case in Italy over the Google executives who were convicted and what that may mean for free speech around the globe. Is there global free speech? We'll talk about it. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Cuba has announced the death of a leading political dissident after a long hunger strike. It's the first death of its kind in Cuba for nearly 40 years. The funeral of the hunger striker Orlando Zapata will be held in a few hours' time. To get more details, we spoke with Marcelo Justo of the BBC's Spanish-American service. He's been following the story, and he told us why Orlando Zapata was on hunger strike.
Well, he was arrested in 2003 with 75 dissidents jailed by the authorities. And first he was sentenced to 3 years in prison. Then this was increased to 25 years after he was charged with disobedience and disorder at the prison there in Cuba. And he was basically protesting against all this and against the treatment of prisoners there in Cuba. And it was a very long held protest, 85 days, refusing food. And that eventually led to his death.
He starved to death at the age of 42. I understand that Cuban President Raul Castro made a public statement about this. What was his response?
Exactly. He lamented the death of a detained activist of Orlando Zapata Tamayo, but he said, this is very strange, in general it's a very rare expression of sorrow by the leadership in Cuba, but at the same time he accused the United States of and the tensions between the United States and Cuba of what has happened, saying that without these tensions and because of these tensions, thousands of Cubans had died, and he included Orlando Zapata's death into this group of people who had died due to this tension, this long-held political tension between the United States and Cuba.
So he basically blamed Zapata's death on the United States, but one thing that is notable in Raul Castro's comments is that he actually admitted that there are political prisoners in Cuban jails.
Yeah, well, what he said, what he didn't kind of quite refer to that. What he said in his terms was basically that there were no person had been killed or assassinated by the Cuban forces. No person had been tortured. And he compared the case of Cuba with the situation in the United States and what was happening, he said, in the Cuban state. And he made reference to Guantanamo. He said, not in Cuban territory, because Guantanamo is in Cuban territory, but under United States jurisdiction. And over there, yes, people are assassinated and people are tortured. So in a way, it was a way of recognizing the presence of prisoners of conscience, but at the same time he was saying we don't do anything kind of, you know, against the human rights with them.
Is there expected to be a widespread public response, especially at the funeral of Orlando Zapata today?
Well, there's been a lot of arrests previous to that, according to the opposition group. So probably that has neutralized a bit the possibility of the opposition to express themselves at this funeral. But this funeral will take place within an hour or two, and so we'll see very soon.
That was Marcelo Justo of the BBC's Spanish American Service. He joined us earlier this morning. He was talking about the death of Orlando Zapata, a political dissident that was being held in a Cuban jail. Zapata died after a long hunger strike.
Good morning, John Hockenberry back here with Celeste Headlee. And on our tech segment this Thursday, we're going to talk about whether convictions of Google executives in Italy may have launched a global war on free speech as far as the internet is concerned. We'll talk about that in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on leading stories. They're coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. Economic news just out. New jobless claims rose unexpectedly last week as businesses boosted layoffs. Also some mixed numbers that are disturbing the markets on the demand for durable goods. Staying on jobs, the Senate yesterday passed a major jobs bill. It would allow businesses tax breaks if they hire the unemployed. And in a little over an hour, President Obama and members of Congress will weigh in on health care reform during a six-hour meeting to be broadcast live on television. We'll be streaming the healthcare meeting live on our website at thetakeaway.org. It kicks off at 10 o'clock Eastern Time, and we want to hear your reactions. Blog live to us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
At the Winter Olympics today, if anyone's game with seven medal events, it's anyone's game, I should excuse me, with seven medal events are scheduled. This includes ice hockey, freestyle skating, and more figure skating as well. Yesterday, the U.S. took two bronze medals. One of the winners was U.S. skater Lana Gehring, whose team won a bronze medal after South Korea was disqualified. She says the win was a major achievement.
We train day after day, you know, hours upon hours, and, you know, we deserve that medal for sure.
The U.S. leads the medal count with 28. General Motors says it will discontinue its Hummer SUV after a deal to sell it to a Chinese manufacturer fell through. To get the Chinese perspective on this, we spoke with BBC China editor Shirong Chen. He joined us earlier from London, and he filled us in on why the deal fell through.
I think, first of all, Tendrong failed to get it all passed through the Chinese regulator because the officials, the Chinese government, even though they are eager to get foreign assets like automobiles, but they are not that desperate. And from the very beginning, there's a controversy around whether Hum is a good brand. And some commentators in China are saying for the company to do this acquisition, number one, they don't have the capital. Number two, they don't have the experience. Number three, they don't have the technology. Now you match that with the Hummer. They say, number one, no future. Number two, no market. Number three, no popularity. Apparently, it is sold less than 60 units in China last year. So who would see that deal could come through?
Is there a big market for large trucks and SUVs in China?
Oh, there is a big market, but as people are talking about climate change and green technology, green living, so that market is shrinking. And also, when people talk about U.S. brand, it's no longer the Hummer. Probably the luxury brand rather than the gas guzzling ones.
That was Shirong Chen, China editor for our partner, the BBC. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
So our tech segment this Thursday involves the law, which is a very sort of low-tech operation, but it's also the highest tech of companies around the world, Google. An Italian court yesterday found three Google executives guilty of invasion of privacy because of an offensive video posted to Google Video. The video depicted a boy with Down syndrome being bullied by four teenagers. Google was alerted to it. They took it down. But prosecutors argued that it should never have been allowed on Google Video in the first place. And it violated Italian privacy laws, and therefore Google was liable. Three executives were convicted. Joining us now to talk about this are Jeff Rosen, law professor at George Washington University, and Clive Thompson, tech writer, whose work regularly appears in Wired and the New York Times, and who regularly appears on this show. Now, global companies have standards and practices people as a matter of course in all nations where they operate, gentlemen, to make sure they're complying with the laws and the rules. Clive Thompson, how is this case different?
Well, this one is a little bit different because the EU, you know, had an existing law from several years before that did the same sort of thing it does in the U.S., where it says if there's anyone who's hosting stuff online, like videos or blogs or comments, they're not liable for what's on those sites, so long as if they get a complaint right. about something, they take it down quickly, sort of a safe harbor. And so Google thought that it was going along with the law of the land in the EU, as it does in the U.S. and other countries.
So, Jeff Rosen, first of all, is there any notion, vague or otherwise, of a kind of globally accepted standard of free speech that might be a guide here on the Internet?
There's really not. It's striking that the person who has more control over free speech than any judge or any king is the deputy general counsel of Google. It's a woman called Nicole Wong. She's called the decider. And basically, she's woken up in the middle of the night. She gets calls from the Turkish government, which says that their privacy laws are being invaded because Greek football fans are calling the founder of Turkey gay. Or in Thailand, it's a crime to insult the king. And basically, Google has to comply with local laws, with laws in all the countries in which it operates, because if it doesn't, its employees will be thrown in jail. The only real free speech standard, as Clive suggested, the only global notion is not holding platforms like Google liable for what they post. And in the U.S., that's a clear standard because the Communications Decency Act says that content providers can't be held liable as long as they don't make content decisions. In the EU, there was this broad understanding that there'd be a similar principle applied. But by thwarting that principle, the Italian criminal court has frightened not only Google, but media companies throughout the world, because all of them fear that their employees could be hauled off to jail because of content that other people post.
This is as low-tech as it gets. And this is basically a standard that if I take a libelous poster and put it up on a CBS-owned billboard that happens to be blank, what the Italians have done is said that CBS is liable if they don't take it down, that the prosecutors don't have to come after me. There's no really high technology involved here, except for the fact that Google is this ubiquitous brand that operates everywhere in the world. Clive Thompson, is Google in a position to basically create a template for international law based on its corporate policies around the world?
Well, no. I mean, countries are sovereign and they can do as they will. And Google, as Jeffrey said, often has to work around countries' laws.
But there are precedents that are going to be set here. I mean, if Google plays this badly, the precedents could go one way. If they do it another way, it could go another way.
Well, it is interesting. Some people have speculated that what Italy has done here is sort of shot itself in the foot, because a lot of not just Google, but a lot of internet companies that offer services might think twice about offering that service in Italy. If they have, something, we're going to host tweet-like things, Well, what if someone defames someone else in a tweet that is, hosted by your company in Italy? Are you going to get hauled into court? So the response could be not, Italy, we want you to change your law, but we're just not going to participate. We're not going to play ball in Italy.
Jeff Rosen, is the value of something like Google and just the Internet in general degraded by depending on how this goes, in the sense that if you're broadcasting to the world on some sort of Facebook page, you believe, and that's sort of the product that you're buying, that you're broadcasting to the whole world, when in fact the way this could go is you're actually broadcasting to a bunch of filters that may or may not let your content be seen?
That's a real danger. Obviously, in China, it was very acute, so much so that Google eventually decided they're not going to play anymore. But there is a solution to this, some form of transparency. In Germany, for example, Google has to take down Holocaust denial videos, which are illegal in Germany, although not in the U.S., but they post a link to a public interest website saying, this link has been removed, and if you want to find it, here's the archive. So that, at least, people know that when things are being filtered, they know what they're getting, and then they can make a decision about whether to search on the German Google or the French Google or whatever. That's one sort of solution.
And very quickly, Jeff Rosen, is there a solution here for Google to maybe do it better than maybe having a single decider who gets wakened up in the middle of the night operating this sort of thing?
Google does have a solution they prefer. Nicole Wong says, I can't deal with this. It's too much work. I prefer that democratic countries tell me what to remove. So in Germany, for example, there's a state body that identifies YouTube videos that it wants taken down and notifies Google. Google would prefer that Italy do that too. Italy hasn't done that. But ironically, that solution might protect less speech than Google does right now, because Nicole Wong is actually pretty pro-free speech.
Well, that's really fascinating, a process to replace a gatekeeper there, the powerful Nicole Wong at Google. Jeff Rosen is law professor at George Washington Washington University, and Clive Thompson, tech writer whose work regularly appears on this program and our partner, The New York Times, and in Wired. Thanks so much to both of you.
Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about transportation. It's part of a project with our home station, WNYC, and we're going to look at gas prices and commuting costs and how they're actually tied to the foreclosure crisis. But we need your reporting on this issue. We want you to tell us, how has rising gas prices, maybe bus fares, hit your wallet, and has it affected any other parts of your lifestyle? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And while you're at the website, thetakeaway.org, you can catch up on our series, Frustration Nation and the Problems with Congressional Gridlock.
Politics has become more or less about the R or the D behind your name than actually getting anything done.
That's one takeaway from high school civic student Amina Green in Detroit. Listen to more about what she said and the whole series at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
You can hear why she says she's still gonna vote. I'm John Hockenberry. Most hopeful thing I heard all morning. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. The healthcare reform bullies find themselves a new pulpit.
Show me what you got.
We didn't come here just to do nothing.
Don't let the American people go another 20 years without health insurance reform in this country.
And this silly talk about having no ideas. I mean, we've heard that ad nauseum.
In about an hour, as Washington, D.C. contemplates another snow day, Democrats and Republicans lock themselves away for 6 hours with the cameras rolling to talk health care reform. They're calling it a summit meeting, like in the Cold War days, back when there were translators present. This time, not likely. Healthcare takes a trip to the mountaintop on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, February 25th, and the takeaway is the healthcare reform revolution of President Obama apparently will be televised for 6 hours today.
That's actually true. And you could sit through all 6 hours if you really wanted to. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. An hour from now, President Obama will try to revive his plan to overhaul healthcare. He and 22 influential lawmakers will lock themselves in a room at the Blair House in Washington for 6 hours to try and find common ground. And for good measure, as we said, it'll all be televised. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs tells CBS News this morning.
We want to hear again from Republicans and incorporate even more of the ideas that they have into the president's proposal. We know that if we do nothing, health care will continue to skyrocket.
You can hear the healthcare debate live at thetakeaway.org. It starts at 10 a.m. Eastern.
Well, Jonathan Cohn, senior editor for The New Republic, will be listening when everything gets started. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Jonathan, is this summit, pageant, Supreme Court of public opinion, whatever you want to call it, a sign of desperation on the part of the administration, or could it be the seed of a new initiative?
Actually, I think neither. I think this is a chance to finish the work on the comprehensive bill they've been spending more than a year working on already.
Well, we'll talk about what the constitutional implications of appealing to a court of public opinion is for the Obama administration and what's likely to come out of this summit in just a moment. Stay with it.
Members of Congress did press Toyota's CEO yesterday about when the automaker knew about the safety problems that have been linked to 34 deaths and what the company did about it. Akio Toyoda didn't respond to that directly, but he did apologize.
I am deeply sorry for any accident that Toyota drivers have experienced.
Toyota insisted the problem is not with the car's electronic systems. That's something that U.S. safety regulators dispute. SeaWorld has suspended its killer whale shows at all of its parks, including San Diego and San Antonio, after yesterday's death of a trainer in Orlando. SeaWorld's chief animal officer, Billy Hurley, says the whale involved in yesterday's attack will not be pulled down.
The concept of euthanasia or discarding the animal is not even considered.
This is the third time that this 30-year-old 12,000-pound killer whale has been involved in a human death.
In Afghanistan, with the country's flag now flying over the city of Marja, U.S. forces say the neighboring province of Kandahar will be the next focus of the NATO offensive. NATO troops are still sweeping the city of Marja, though, clearing out pockets of resistance. At the Olympics, the U.S. men's hockey team beat Switzerland 2-0, while Canada ran over Russia 7-3. The U.S. took two bronze medals, including Aaron Pack in the women's bobsled.
It doesn't feel real yet because we don't have it in our hands, but I'm just so excited.
The U.S. team is excited. The medal count now stands at 28 for the U.S., Germany catching up with 24, Norway has 18, and we'll have another update on the games with the New York Times Olympics editor in just about 20 minutes. The number of new claims for unemployment benefits jumped unexpectedly last week. It's driving futures down, along with a mixed report on durable goods demand. The Dow gets underway at 10,374. The S&P opens at 1,105, and the NASDAQ opens probably negatively at 22.35. Coming up, we've got a new project from our home station, WNYC. We're looking at transportation around the country. Today, we talk about how the administration's work is going to affect commuters around the country. That's later on this hour.
And we continue our series, Frustration Nation. President Obama is holding this bipartisan health care summit. What do you think it'll take to get the two parties to get along?
This is John from KPAC. The only way to get the two parties to ever agree on anything is to abolish the two-party system.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. More about that healthcare summit in a moment.
Good morning, everyone. As the snow begins to fall in Washington, D.C., there are at least, by my count, 26 or so people in Washington who will have a reason to stay indoors for 6 hours that has nothing whatsoever to do with the snow.
Absolutely nothing, yep. Unless one of them slips and breaks a bone.
Right, and God forbid that that would happen. Right. But at about 10 o'clock Eastern Time, the Healthcare Reform Summit convenes to live television cameras as the president gathers with prominent Democrats and Republicans to try to hammer out in public some sort of compromise on healthcare reform. Now, the Constitution makes no mention of summits, but I'm wondering, Darrell West, who's the vice president and director of governance studies at the Brookings Institution, if this whole spectacle pageant summit, call it what you will, looks a little bit like Obama is convening a Supreme Court to overrule gridlock in the traditional Congress of the House of Representatives and the Senate. Darrell?
Well, he does hope to overturn gridlock because right now the two chambers are paralyzed and it's been very difficult to get the momentum to move forward. And I think the summit really provides an opportunity for Democrats to push the reset button. They've introduced some new elements. They have a proposal to give the federal government authority to block excessive insurance premiums. And I think Obama sees this as really his last chance to try and make this sale to the American public and to bring his own party together so they can actually pass health care reform.
Politically, Jonathan Cohn, senior editor for The New Republic, we spoke to you right at the top of the hour. Obama looks really great on television. There's really no dispute about that. But translating that great look on TV into concrete legislation has been a real problem. How does this get us farther down the road?
Well, I think there's two chief goals here. Number one, I think this, everybody says they want bipartisanship. So he's saying, all right, let's give people bipartisanship. Let's put us both in the same room, talk about our ideas. Now, I suspect that we will discover that, in fact, the two parties just have very different ideas here, and that the Republicans, in particular, are at their core not interested in doing health care reform. If that happens, then I think what he wants to do is he wants the American people to see that, and he wants to let the American people know, what is in this bill. Because even though the bill itself is unpopular, when you break it down and tell people what's in it, remarkably, they like all the elements. So I think this is a chance to sit in front of the American people and say, look, this is what you said you wanted. I know it's been a messy process. I know you're turned off by the deal-making and all of that, but if we can pass this bill, we can actually do something to help you, and you won't have to worry about health care so much anymore.
Although implicitly, you're suggesting that the administration, having not done this up till now, maybe that's one of the key failings. Now, let's not talk about that for right this second, but Darrell West, Governance Studies, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. Now, you're aware of some of the disputes and arguments over actually how to frame this entire summit, even how it's going to actually look. How are some of those arguments between Republicans and Democrats about the seating of the chairs indicate the sets of priorities behind the scenes here?
Well, the little things help to set the agenda for the big things. And I think what Democrats really need to do is to play to their strong suit, because even though some elements of health care reform are not very popular, people actually don't like the status quo either. They don't like health insurance companies raising premiums. We've seen some health companies in California propose 25% to 30% increases. That's just simply unacceptable when inflation is running 2% to 3% nationally. They need to basically explain how their insurance changes are going to help the average American get rid of pre-existing conditions and make the plight of Americans better than it is under the current status quo.
Well, but does that mean they're arguing about who's going to use PowerPoint, who's not, who's going to have charts, who's not, who's going to be sitting near the podium, lectern or no lectern?
The biggest argument actually was over who would actually attend the summit. President Obama actually invited Republican Senator Olympia Snowe because her own Republican leadership had not invited her. She ended up declining. And then Republicans invited a Democrat, Congressman Bart Stupak, who has been the author of this controversial anti-abortion amendment.
Right. And so that indicates that clearly the bipartisan interest of the administration in talking to Olympia Snowe is one issue, and making sure that abortion question is in the debate is certainly an interest for the Republicans, right?
Absolutely, because each side understands the weaknesses of the opposition. So not only do they want to make their own case, they want to exploit some of the internal divisions that exist on the other side.
Jonathan Cohn, senior editor for the New Republic. Can I like hammer you with a possibly controversial premise here?
Please.
All right. The lesson supposedly of all administrations is when you get a mandate, you do the hard stuff first, because you're not going to have much of a chance to do it later on in the administration when you get closer to reelection time and the congressional off-year elections, that sort of thing. Perhaps the lesson is just the obvious, is just the opposite here, that if you take Clinton plus Obama, doing health care first is actually a huge mistake. What do you think about that?
Well, Clinton didn't do health care first, right? I mean, he did NAFTA, he did budget, and then he didn't even get to health care until very late in his first year. And, you know, there is this idea out there, well, you know, if only Obama had talked more about jobs, he would be better able to do health care later. Well, what that tends to miss is the fact that, you know, he did talk about jobs. He didn't do more about jobs because the Senate wouldn't let him do more about jobs.
Although there's an argument there. I mean, 17 Republicans crossed the line yesterday in the Senate vote on the jobs bill.
Well, funny, once they were able to break the filibuster to get the actual vote, 17 Republicans crossed the aisle. And I think there's a lesson about the Republican hypocrisy here, which is that they are trying to – you have senators voting to stop votes who say, no, 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 we can't have this vote, we can't have this vote. And then when the bill actually comes up and they're actually going to be held accountable for that vote, they want to be on the winning side. They want to be the ones who help to bring jobs to the American people. Substantively, I think that jobs bill we just passed is pretty small stuff. It's only $15 billion. It's a drop in the bucket. And that actually, you know, gets back to what I was saying before, which is that, you know, he did jobs and he couldn't do more on jobs because the Senate wouldn't do more on jobs.
So maybe this is a way of finding small stuff in health care and getting that passed. So, Jonathan Cohn, is this an infomercial or not? It sounds like you're saying it's not an infomercial.
I do not think so.
Darryl,
I think, in fact,
Darryl West, your view?
I agree. I think this is really the last opportunity to explain to the American public why we need to do this and why reforming health care is actually crucial for long-term economic competitiveness, because
right, well,
small businesses simply can't survive the current high cost of health care.
All right. So 6 hours perhaps well spent. Darryl West, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and Jonathan Cohn, Senior Editor for the New Republic. Thanks so much. And at 15 minutes after the hour, 45 minutes away from that healthcare summit, we're going to check some other stories.
The number of new claims for unemployment benefits jumped unexpectedly by 22,000 last week. And speaking of jobs, Senate Democrats passed the major jobs bill yesterday that they were just talking about. Here's New York Senator Chuck Schumer.
It will do some good for the hundreds of thousands and perhaps millions who are looking desperately for work.
The bill would give businesses tax breaks if they hire the unemployed.
Here in New York, two more people allegedly connected to the plot to blow up the New York subway will appear in court today. Excuse me, and they're not strangling me at this point. The defendants are reputed to be friends of Najib Al-Azazi, who's already been sentenced to life in jail without parole. Finally, in Afghanistan, the Taliban stronghold of Marja is under government control today. But NATO spokesman Brigadier General Eric Tremblay says there's still plenty of work to do.
We will need a few more days to clear Marja and improve the security situation by separating the insurgent from the population.
And it looks like NATO's next target will be the neighboring province of Kandahar, a Taliban stronghold as well. France has confirmed that the suspected killers of a Hamas leader in Dubai last month used forged French passports. The French foreign ministry said three suspects had stolen the identity of French citizens. Meanwhile, police in Dubai have identified 26 suspects in that assassination, traveling on European and Australian passports. Israel has been widely blamed for the killing, but has denied any involvement. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, new jobless claims out this morning. What story do they tell about the economy and unemployment? We talked to Kelly Evans for an answer. The statistics are really moving the markets. Futures are way down. She'll join us in just a few moments.
Hey, you want that to go?
We've got some takeouts on news stories that we're following this week, and we just have found out that jobless claims spiked unexpectedly last week by 22,000. Kelly Evans joins us to explain. She's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. And Kelly, we understand that the spike in jobless claims is partly due to inclement weather on the eastern seaboard. Is that right?
That's right. I wouldn't say this is necessarily an unexpected increase, because I think as soon as the snowstorms proved to be as severe as they were a couple weeks ago, economists have kind of been on high alert to see how they might affect the data coming in. And I think, I think if you look this week, already we're getting an indication that it really has interfered. I mean, consumer confidence released on Tuesday really plunged across the board. There was no indication that had anything to do with the snow, but it did raise some eyebrows. And then you have today's report showing that jobless claims jumped last week. Now, the Labor Department says that's because they were still processing claims from a few weeks ago. They were under the same backlog, you know, hard to get into the office that everyone else faced. And certainly there are some economists who say, you know, the jobs report that we get next month might not look too pretty. I mean, if you look at the past record, if you look at the snowstorm that hit in January 1996, you know, that had a drop in payrolls the following month of 200,000. So
wow.
for a month, there were all the fears of a double dip at that point sort of looked to be right on, until the following month showed a gain of 700,000 in the payroll report. So I think what this does is suggest the snowstorm did have an impact on the economy. Unfortunately, it comes at a time when we're really trying to get signs as to whether, you know, things are improving or not, and this makes that a lot more
difficult.
And we're
watching the numbers extremely carefully as the snow falls outside the window here in New York. Kelly Evans is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
And it's all moving the markets. Futures are still way down. Wall Street opens in about 7 minutes. For our next takeout, Jason Stallman comes back, Olympics editor for The New York Times. Jason, this is my first conversation with you during the Olympics here. I've been off for a little while, but I've been watching the games quite a bit. You're having a great time out there, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, here's my question for you, though. I've actually been watching a fair amount of curling, okay? And it seems to me that the sport of curling, very, very popular in Canada and some other places in the universe, has really benefited from NBC's, like, proliferation of 50,000 cameras and different angles and all these sort of digital boxes on the screen. Do you think they're betting that with enough digital sort of largesse, curling can be a hugely popular sport?
I think they're wise to the notion that curling is somewhat of a novelty, and even if people are watching it only to laugh at it and to make fun of it and question whether these are truly athletes, it does seem to resonate every 4 years. It's just so different than anything we're used to watching.
Well, it looks like a video game up there, and for that reason, it seems much more accessible. Explain the rules again.
Well, I tell you what, I think it's more enjoyable if you don't truly understand the rules, but it's, you know, it's not unlike something like shuffleboard. They're sliding a stone down a sheet of ice, and they're, you know, aiming it toward a circular target, and it's a thinking man's game. It's a game of angles. And, you know, leave the questions of athleticism aside. It's fun to watch.
It is fun to watch. And who's favored for the gold?
Canada,
yeah,
runaway favorite. And they have a really compelling skip or team leader. His name's Kevin Martin. They call him Kmart. And he absolutely does not look anything like what most people consider an Olympic athlete. 43 years old, balding, but he is rock star status in Canada.
Before we go, shifting to women's figure skating, can the Korean Kim Yuna, the favorite, who now has racked up such a huge score, be caught at this point?
Boy, it'll be really tough. You know, people are saying that she's going to have to fall down or something in order to be caught, but she's so superior that even if she falls, her technical components will probably make up for it. She could fall down and still win. However, her chief rival, Mao Asada of Japan, is planning to try to execute two triple axels. She's the first woman to execute a triple axel, one triple axel in the Olympics. She's going to try to pull off two in the free skate. If she does that, maybe it'll get close.
Well, maybe some suspense, but probably not much. But certainly a breathtaking skill and talent there on the ice with the Korean Kim Yoon-na. Jason Stallman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jason, of course, is the Olympics editor for our partner, the New York Times, there in Vancouver, Canada.
And our last takeout is from you, and it's about technology. We talked about broadband internet yesterday and the government's plan to bring affordable high-speed hookups even to outlying rural areas. But Dwayne in the Detroit area called in to say the problem isn't just restricted to the countryside.
I have internet access, but only through satellite or by cellular broadband on USB connection to a laptop. And I'm just 15 minutes away from three major metropolitan areas. Right off of a major highway.
Dwayne, not many choices for internet there, but the story about internet access is that it's so dependent on where you live.
My name is Randy Oakham, and I got my laptop, and I just steal Wi-Fi. I don't even pay for it. I can sit in the middle of my living room and steal five different Wi-Fis. That's the way everyone should do it. It should be free. There should be Wi-Fi in every corner.
I applaud your initiative, Randy. I do want to point out one thing, though, is that while you're stealing the Wi-Fi, everyone can't steal it, because at some point, somebody has to pay for the Wi-Fi that you take.
Although eventually, I think he's right. It probably will be.
Eventually.
Free. It's probably going to be free. It's going to be so ubiquitous. So, you know, I was away for about a week, and I found this really sad story. These two radio hosts who were forced to eat expired food.
That was an interesting story, John.
What were you guys thinking?
It was totally fine. That food was fine. That was really interesting.
And this is about to figure out if you need to trust expiration dates.
Well, it turns
produce.
Out they're arbitrary. There's no rules on how when to put these expiration dates on. The companies choose.
Well, I saw this comment from Ponto in Maryland. He writes, I once struggled over whether to buy shucked oysters from the bargain bin of a local store. It was very cheap, but I knew it might be a problem. I did buy them, and I made a superb oyster stew. I had no ill effects, but the tension of waiting out the oysters negated the value of the bargain. Have you waited out the food that you ate?
I feel fine.
Right. I don't know if I want to hear food poisoning roulette, although it is an intriguing sort of game. You can check it out at thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, we're going to hear about some people who are taking advantage of the earthquake that occurred in Haiti by trying to make money off of refugees who are trying to get temporary protected status in the United States. That's coming up in a few minutes. Also, we're going to talk transportation tomorrow, and we need you to be our feet on the street. We're going to be talking about gas prices and commuting costs and how that's affected the larger economy. Let us know your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, when the earthquake occurred in Haiti, some people rushed to help. Millions of people rushed to give money. A few people rushed to cash in on the crisis. We're going to talk about some scams that have surrounded the Haiti earthquake in just a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. In just about a half an hour, President Obama will mediate a televised debate between Democrats and Republicans on health care reform. Earlier this morning, we spoke to Daryl West from the Brookings Institution, who told us it's now or never for the president's bill.
Obama sees this as really his last chance to try and make this sale to the American public and to bring his own party together so they can actually pass health care reform.
But House Minority Whip Eric Cantor tells CBS News this morning.
We're going in because Republicans do care about improving health care for America and its families, and we just don't care for this bill of his.
You can hear the healthcare debate live at thetakeaway.org. It's due to start in just about a half an hour at 10 a.m. Eastern. With that as the backdrop, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is asking the heads of five major health insurance companies to meet with her next month. She wants them to explain why their premiums are on the rise.
Markets are falling off the cliff this morning. Futures are responding to a surprise increase in the number of weekly unemployment benefits that jumped unexpectedly last month. Also, a mixed demand for durable goods. The Dow is off 163 points at this hour. The Nasdaq, right at the open, off 32 points, and the S&P is off 14.77 points. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
After the Haiti earthquake, not everyone's response was charitable. A small minority decided to use it as an opportunity to make some money. Authorities in New York are investigating unscrupulous scam artists. They've been trying to provide phony legal services to Haitian immigrants. These are Haitian immigrants who want to take advantage of the United States government offer of a temporary protected status. With details, we've got the Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr. He says his department has been getting complaints of scam artists charging Haitians exorbitant fees to apply for the immigration benefit. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste. How are you?
I'm doing well. Can you tell me what's the scope of this? How many complaints has your office received, and what are the complaints detail?
Well, we received a number of complaints. I think the scope is enough to cause us concern, and particularly in light of the very difficult situation for the Haitian community. And the kinds of cases that are involved here are people who are preying upon Haitians because of their vulnerable situation. They include situations where someone pretends to be a lawyer who is not, someone who pretends to be a professional, like a government agent or real estate agent, offering to provide specific services, or a promise for a successful completion of documents, or simply someone who is unlicensed to practice law, engaging in the practice of law. The bottom line in all of this is that we have a very vulnerable group of people, and people are taking advantage of them in that time of need by falsely representing either who they are or what they can do, all motivated by profit.
Who are these people who are pretending to be lawyers or government agents? Are they American citizens? Are they Haitian?
It can be a mix. It can be a mix. Some members of the community. I think we're finding in our complaints that it is a mix. It's not dependent on any one particular individual.
Okay, this is not limited to New York, certainly. In Massachusetts, the Catholic Charities of Boston have also been running legal clinics to help Haitian immigrants there avoid these kind of scams. Margene Perhote is the organization's Director of Refugee and Immigration Services. Good morning, Margene.
Good morning, Celeste.
So you have actually held 5 information sessions for Haitians. Have you gotten complaints from your clients?
Yes, Celeste, we have. And to reiterate what Attorney Vance was saying, we are seeing the very same things here in the Boston region. And our immigration legal clinics have been set up to hopefully prevent Haitians from being taken advantage of. But we do have folks coming in and saying, this person around the corner said that I could get my family here for $5,000, and is this possible? And so we are very fortunate that we've got an amazing group of immigration attorneys to help prevent vulnerable Haitians from being taken advantage of.
So give me an example of that story that you just said. Someone offers to bring someone's family here for $5,000, and perhaps this person raises $5,000 and pays it to the person. Then what happens?
Well, unfortunately, what happens right now, Celeste, is there's not a lot of provisions within the law to bring families here quickly. So this is happening to Haitians who really want to get their families off the streets in Port-au-Prince. And so they're desperate. And then they find out that once they go to Haiti to try to bring their family out, there's no legal mechanism to do so. So they've spent all this money, and now their family is still trapped in Haiti, and now they have $5,000 less to support the family back home.
Okay, Margene Perhote, she's the Director of Refugee and Immigration Services. You heard the district attorney from Manhattan say that there's a mix among the people, these scam artists, these con artists. Are you finding the same thing there in Boston, that they're both a mix of Haitians and American citizens that are doing this?
Exactly the same. It's really not different. And this problem has been plaguing the immigrant community for years. It's not new to the Haitian situation. So it's always something that we're keenly aware of, because we often, as Catholic Charities, receive the person after they've been scammed by these nefarious individuals.
Cyrus Vance, what is the legal jurisdiction here? If someone is a Haitian immigrant, what powers do you have to prosecute them for this kind of thing?
Well, first of all, I think just to follow up on the comments from Catholic Charities, this isn't just about prosecution. I think the goal of all of us here is about how to prevent these from occurring in the first place. And that's why we, in fact, several weeks ago, working with our local borough president, Catholic Charities, a number of providers held a Help for Haitians seminar and meeting on a Saturday, where we brought not only our community and the federal government, but the Catholic Charities and other providers to both alert people to what was going on, help the Haitians know how they can legitimately apply for temporary protected status, and provide essentially wraparound services both to alert and prevent the crime and help those who are in need appropriately document their document their applications. What basically we have here is simply fraud and theft. The jurisdiction is really straightforward. People are being conned. They are being told that someone can deliver a product or an event that is false. Money is being paid to do it, and it's a scam. It's really a fairly straightforward situation of theft.
Okay, that's Cyrus Vance. He's the Manhattan District Attorney. Margene Perhote of the Catholic Charities of Boston. How much should it cost a Haitian immigrant to apply for temporary protected status?
The average filing fee that they have to pay to the U.S. government is $470. And with so many generous providers, such as the Catholic Charities, both here and in New York, many agencies are doing this for free. So I encourage Haitians to look for the TPS clinics or workshops in their areas and get this service for free, because there's many, many dedicated attorneys who want to help Haitians and ensure that they're not being taken advantage of.
Okay, Margene Perhote is the Director of Refugee and Immigration Services for Catholic Charities of Boston. For Haitians who think they may have encountered some suspect immigration services, we have a link on our website to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Just go to thetakeaway.org. Also, we have this new project that we're working on with our home station, WNYC. We're taking a look at transportation issues around the country. And today we're going to talk about how the administration's work could affect civil rights, how transportation becomes a civil rights issue around the country. That's later on this hour. And we're also looking for you to be our reporter on the ground. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about the hikes in gas prices and commuter trains. And we're wondering how that's affected you, because it has affected the foreclosure prices. How have you changed maybe the way you've lived or the way you've traveled because of gas rate hikes and commuting price increases? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Yesterday afternoon, SeaWorld Orlando's largest killer whale dragged its trainer, Dawn Branchot, underwater, and she was drowned. Here's how Wayne Gillespie, a tourist at the park and a witness, described the scene.
We never saw, like, any biting or anything. It just looked like it was playing at first. Like, it never seemed to be, like, aggressively trying to hurt her in any way.
The killer whale was actually involved in two previous deaths. In 1999, it killed another person at the same park, and it was also one of three whales blamed for drowning a trainer at a different park 8 years earlier. Bianca Prieto is covering this story for the Orlando Sentinel. Bianca, you were at the park yesterday. What did you see, and what did park officials say in response to the incident?
Hi there. Yeah, I was at the park yesterday. I was one of the first reporters on the scene. And for a long while, the spokesman wouldn't tell us anything. They had us all corralled inside of a pavilion. When they finally did come out, the Orange County Sheriff's Office told us that, you know, the woman had slipped and fell into the waters and had been fatally injured. Dan Brown, someone with the SeaWorld, repeated the same thing and basically said, you know, that they were investigating everything, that they were looking into their policies and procedures, and wanted to find out how their quote-unquote family member had passed away yesterday.
This, as I said, this killer whale has been involved in two previous deaths. There's no actual conclusive evidence tying him to the deaths of two other people, but he was one of three whales that was blamed for the 1991 drowning of a trainer when he performed in Canada. And also in 1999, they found the body of someone who had snuck into the park, and the man was found dead lying across the whale's back, though they don't have any way of knowing exactly what happened there. Why was the animal still performing if we knew he had a violent past?
The animal is a valuable asset. We've been told that the animal is a valuable asset to the park, and that it's had thousands of interactions with humans, with trainers, without an incident. Also, Tilly, the whale, was a father, and he would father many of the calves there, and he was used a lot for breeding.
So what happens to this whale now? We've already heard that they're not thinking of euthanasia or ridding themselves of the animal at all. Will the animal eventually be sent? Is there some kind of reserve where killer whales can be sent?
This morning, the Orlando Sentinel is definitely looking into that. We are trying to find out what SeaWorld is going to do with Tilly, what his future is, but nothing has been decided yet that we've been made aware of.
But it has been made clear that the whale would not be released into the wild.
That's what we're hearing, yes.
And what are animal rights activists in Florida saying about this?
Animal rights activists have long said that they don't think that these giant mammals should be kept in captivity and forced to perform, that these are wild animals that deserve to be out living in the ocean.
And killer whales don't have a dangerous reputation, actually, out in the wild.
That's right.
Okay, Bianca Prieto is a criminal justice reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. She's talking about an incident yesterday afternoon at SeaWorld Orlando, the largest killer whale there, dragged trainer Dawn Branchot underwater. She was drowned there, and apparently the killer whale has been involved in two previous deaths, one in 1999 and one in 1991. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee, joined here again by John Hockenberry, who's come back after being away for a little while.
I came back.
Coming up, well, there's a new project with our home station, WNYC. We're looking at transportation around the country and how communities are affected by it. Today, we're looking at a funding coming out of the government, which asks not just that something be cost-effective, not just that a project be shovel-ready and ready to go, but also that it satisfy civil rights policies out of the Obama White House. We're going to talk about that in a moment. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. In about 10 minutes, President Obama will mediate a televised debate between Democrats and Republicans on health care. You can hear that live at thetakeaway.org.
And one of the people that's going to be paying close attention to that health care summit is Savlon Hauser, a 27-year-old architect who has to pay for her own insurance. And good morning, Savlon.
Good morning.
So it's 6 hours long. That's a big chunk out of the day, but you're going to listen and watch?
I'm going to be checking blogs and getting updates as they come. I'll definitely be listening. It affects me, so.
Well, of course. And I guess there's a lot of concern as to whether this can actually accomplish anything. What do you think would be the most important thing for you to come out of this bipartisan summit?
Absolutely most important for me, and I think our country is the public option be salvaged from the wreckage. I don't know if how hopeful that is, but I think it's the only way to fundamentally shift our system from private enterprise, which doesn't work. We've tried it, to something that serves everyone.
Well, Savlon, I just give you a little piece of advice. I hope you have a sort of a plan B if your first choice doesn't come through today. But Savlon Hauser, we're going to check in with you tomorrow, 27-year-old architect, like many Americans watching the healthcare reform summit. Last little economic news here. The number of new jobless claims jumped unexpectedly last week. Markets opened down on the news, and they're continuing down. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
The Obama administration is changing the way that it awards funds for transportation projects. It's not just an effort to speed up the way that they are spending this pool of money, but there's also a change in vision on how the money is awarded, what projects get funded. Fair treatment, they say, includes fair access to good transportation across all communities. Here's Federal Transit Administrator Peter Raugoff.
An important part of our need to speed up this process involves quitting all the haggling between the federal government and these agencies about whether they follow and pass a very narrow criterion. Instead, we're going to recognize all of the benefits that transit projects provide, like environmental benefits, mobility benefits, benefits to low-income communities, and that will hopefully speed up our process in getting these projects off the ground.
Let's take a look at these different examples of how money is awarded for transit projects with David Schultz. He's the transportation reporter for WAMU in Washington, D.C. David, you just heard Peter Rogoff talk about three different things. He said environmental benefits, access benefits, and also low-income communities.
Right. That's a big change from the previous funding criteria that was established by the Bush administration. Earlier this year, the Obama administration changed the funding criteria, and now they'll be looking at funding transportation projects that have livability benefits, and that includes economic development and environmental benefits towards economically distressed areas. And one example of that in the D.C. area is a bus grant that is going towards Prince George's County in Maryland and other areas throughout the D.C. region.
Well, explain this project to me, because it's a pretty small fish kind of project.
It is. It's relatively small. It's $15 million, which sounds like a lot, but it's in terms of transportation projects, it's relatively small. The money is going to go towards improving more than 2,600 bus stops, most of those in Prince George's County in economically distressed areas. It'll go towards better signage, new shelters, more benches, better lighting, and just it's a project that's sort of not necessarily designed to shorten commute times like would have been under the previous funding criteria, but it's just designed to get people on buses who wouldn't necessarily be riding buses otherwise.
And what kind of communities will this serve?
This will serve economically underdeveloped areas, areas with lots of African Americans, Latinos, Asians, It's definitely targeted towards those neighborhoods.
So people are seeing it as kind of a victory for low-income communities and minority communities in the D.C. area.
It is, and it's interesting to sort of contrast this with other projects that didn't get funding, like the K Street Busway. That's a project that would have created a dedicated bus lanes on K Street, but that did not get funding. So it's sort of interesting to contrast.
Well, it's interesting also how that particular thing mirrors other things going around in the country. That's David Schultz, transportation reporter for WAMU. And we can go now to Minnesota. Laura Yuen joins us. She's a St. Paul reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
What is the project that you're getting funds for in Minneapolis?
Well, this is called the Central Corridor Project. It's an 11-mile light rail transit route connecting the downtowns of St. Paul and Minneapolis. And this announcement basically made it possible to include three extra stations along this line. And that issue has just been a huge hot-button issue for the communities who would be served by this line. Previously, the three extra stations would not be possible because it's kind of through the what's called the cost effectiveness index out of skew, and
it was too expensive to make these lines that just serve these underserved communities.
That's right.
And they called it a civil rights concern because there were a lot of Asians and African Americans who said, "Look, we need bus service. I mean, light rail service like anyone else does."
Right. I mean, some folks felt that this line was just being built as kind of a pass-through for the rich, you know, commuters who are just trying to get from one city to the next.
Okay. And you're now getting almost $8 million for these three extra stations. That's Laura Yuen, a St. Paul reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. And we're going to go stop at one more place where this new policy on funding is making a difference, and that is in Oakland, California. Guillermo Mayor joins us. He's a senior staff attorney with Public Advocates, a nonprofit law firm and advocacy agency in Oakland, California. Good morning, Guillermo.
Good morning.
So explain to me the story of the BART Oakland Airport connector fight, the fight over this.
Sure. Well, this is the first time that the federal government pulls stimulus funding from a project because local officials did not take the necessary steps to ensure that the project was fair to low-income and minority populations. And at issue is a three-mile connector between the Oakland Airport and a BART station, or the Bay Area Rapid Transit District, which is the commuter rail service here in the San Francisco Bay Area. The project would replace an existing bus shuttle that connects the BART system to the airport with a $500 million rail link. And the concern over this project is that it does not provide any benefits to East Oakland residents that are overwhelmingly African American, Latino, Asian, and low income. What the project does is that it charges a $6 fare to get to the airport and back, so $12 round trip. It includes no intermediate stops so that East Oakland residents can access the many jobs along the 3-mile route. And it really has not included their input. This project has significantly changed, and the community has been left out.
So this was another chance where this is another situation in which you argued that they were creating a pass-through situation for higher-income people. You fought against this, and the Obama administration sided with you.
That's correct. It was unprecedented. You rarely see this kind of agency enforcement of civil rights, and it's great news for it signals a major shift in civil rights enforcement, not only at the Federal Transit Administration, but we think at other federal agencies.
All right. So you're going to get a service from the members, the residents of East Oakland, all the way to the airport, which will include stops along the way so they can get to their jobs.
Well, that's what we want is a project in the end that includes benefits for the community. Whether it ends up being a rail link or an improved bus link is yet to be known.
Okay, Guillermo Mayor is a senior staff attorney with Public Advocates, a nonprofit law firm and advocacy agency. We also spoke with Laura Yuen, St. Paul reporter for Minnesota Public Radio.
Our conversation on transportation is going to continue tomorrow. We're going to look at gas prices and commuting costs and how they're tied to the foreclosure crisis. But we really need your reporting to get that conversation started. Tell us how in your life increasing gas prices or bus fares or train ticket increases have hit your wallet. Give us the cost of your commute or the inflationary figure for your commute at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we want your suggestions as to who had a good week and who had a bad week with our friends at The Week magazine. We tally up everybody's luck this Friday, but we want to hear your take as well. And you know how to reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. And people on Wall Street not having a good week today. The Dow is down significantly, about 151 points. And with the President's Healthcare Summit starting later today, what should you know about it?
Each side understands the weaknesses of the opposition. So not only do they want to make their own case, they want to exploit some of the internal divisions that exist on the other side.
That's the Brookings Institution's Take. What's yours? Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. The summit begins in just a moment.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.